Ladies and gentlemen, student sponsors, board members, please join me in a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome to Mike and Nolan.
Well, thanks, Tim. And I tell you, I wish I had Steve Gergoyan's crystal ball. He books Mike Rogers, and it turns out to be the week of this critical North Korean summit, as well as the G7 meeting, both right in your sweet spot. And he's got Mike Pompeo coming on Monday, probably his first speech, or at least one of his first speech, since returning from Korea. So good job, Steve.
Well done.
So, Congressman, let's start with North Korea. You were on the peninsula last fall, I understand, and have been following very closely the up and down developments between the United States and North Korea during the Trump administration. Give us your assessment of what happened this week, a significant diplomatic breakthrough, or just more of the same old promises we've heard in the past?
Yeah, this one's pretty interesting to me. And as most things the president engages in, there's some good things, and then there's some things you go, what did he just say? And I think this is, I would qualify as one of them. So let me tell you where we were 6 months ago. We had our military training at a tempo that they were gonna go across the 38th parallel. They were ready to go to do it. They had leaked at one point that the Navy SEALs were on the peninsula training specifically to kill Kim Jong-un. Happened to be there then, and the South Koreans liked that message so much, they announced they had a battalion of soldiers training to kill Kim Jong-un. So the rhetoric was really heating up. I mean, it was getting hot. And that's when all of the tweets were going back and forth about whose button was bigger and all of those kind of things. And so the fact that the mold has been broken, I think is a very good sign. The fact that back 6 months ago, we didn't really even have someone to call to try to calm things down. They had no open line of communication. Well, we certainly have that. The fact that you got Kim Jong-un out of the country to expose to the rest of the world, I think is a good thing. I like that he was walking around Singapore, right? You're not gonna find anything like that north of the 38th parallel. That, to me, was a very good sign. So in that regard, I think we made some progress. The missile testing suspension, I know it's been, I've heard a lot of commentators say that was, who cares? It's a big deal to get that. The bad side of it, the fact that the president comes back today and says, oh, it's over, we're gonna be denuked in 3 months or whatever he said.
Yeah.
Not gonna happen. We are a long way from that. I worry that he gets too exuberant about this. And I think he gave up too much up front. He gave up military training exercises, which is, if you're ever gonna deploy a US military with anyone, we do this in NATO a lot. They have these very big integration exercises, mainly so that we don't have problems if something bad happens. I understand you have lieutenants and captains and sergeants who know how to pick up the phone and talk to their South Korean counterparts in any engagement. That's good. And I think he adopted their language and he gave that away. I worry that was too much too fast. That part I wasn't thrilled about. And he used their language, which is war games and provocative. We do joint training exercises all over the world for really good cause, right? It also lets our adversaries understand that we can surge troops and we can be a deterrent. And I worry that he missed that piece of that equation.
So what is Kim Jong-un's motivation, and is it strong enough to actually deliver a denuclearization deal?
I think if I were looking at it through the lens of them, and again, being in South Korea and talking to all their military and defense intelligence folks last fall, some interesting dynamics. One, Kim Jong-un believes that nuclear weapons has given him the ability to leverage the United States off the peninsula. He believes that, right? So in any negotiation, you have to start there. That's where his head is at. So he gave away nothing in that regard. He said, yeah, I don't really want to be a nuclear nation, but he didn't say he's going to allow inspections, allow anyone there, do anything about it. And so I would guess, if we look at history and the way they've negotiated, that this is a first step in a long series of steps that will be very frustrating to everybody. Again, he saw what happened in Libya, right? That didn't turn out all that well. And Gaddafi voluntarily gave up his chemical, nuclear, and biological weapons programs. didn't end well there. He saw what happened in Iraq because they didn't go nuclear. There was a time, if you recall, back in the 80s, they were going to go, they were getting ready to do that. And so I think that they're going to play a long game. I do believe, I'm a little more optimistic than most on this. I do think that there's we've cracked a little bit of light in there that hopefully with a really ramped up and muscular diplomacy, we can continue to widen. And again, we're not talking about bombing each other today. We were 6 or 8 months ago. I think that in and of itself is a good omen.
I think everyone believes that China is the unseen hand here, and China, North Korea, along with Iran and Russia, are part of this new axis of cyber evil, if you will, presenting a tremendous threat both to our national security and our economic system. Why don't you talk to us about the vulnerability of the United States to the cyber attacks from these nations, and how effective is our response?
So four really bad actors in cyberspace that are continually to not only harass us here in the United States, mm-hmm. both through penetrations and destructive attacks, meaning destroying data, but also stealing data. And it's Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And those are the four bad actors. They do it every day. They're trying to get into your networks right here, right now, today, every single day. So those are the big bad actors. Our problem is this: if all of the four countries I named, the government controls the internet. They own it. They can turn it off. They can turn it on. They use it to find dissidents. They use it for their own purposes internal to those countries. We don't have that, and I don't believe we should have it. But 85% of America's networks are private sector networks. And contrary to popular belief, the NSA is not monitoring those networks. It's against the law for them to do that. And so we are at a bit of a disadvantage when they've realized that with a little bit of money, we can cause a lot of problems. Why buy another carrier group for $2 billion when I can invest several million dollars and get some highly trained cyber warriors to get into your networks and cause you all kinds of trouble? And we've seen that. So just recently, the Russians were on our financial networks. They were on our electric grid. That one was just announced about 6 months ago. They had to kick them off of our electric grid. Why? They're thinking about turning off the lights. That's dangerous stuff. The Iranians were attacking US banks in 2012 aggressively. And day after day, they were using something called a DDoS attack, which is trying to overwhelm your system. But we also know that they have the ability to get in and destroy data in those banks. Imagine you show up at your bank on Monday and you don't know how much money that was in your account, and right. They can't tell you how much money was in your account, right? We got a problem. And so that behavior they have realized collectively is high reward, punish America, punish a business, do a destructive attack, get into their networks, low consequence. Really, what have we been able to do to them to get them to slow down? I would argue not much. So when you ask, where are we at? We're a long way from getting this piece right.
So a lot of people in this room work in cybersecurity for private businesses. How vulnerable is our private networks, and what should businesses be doing? What should they be worried about?
Yeah, so there's no cavalry coming over the hill. The US government is not gonna come and save private sector America on this, mainly because they can't. We're not equipped, the government is not equipped to be able to do that, given the way we respect the private networks. So what we're finding is I think that was a Russian event right there. We're finding that the private sector is starting to fill in, and I'm part of a couple of companies that are trying to fill in that gap. But we don't have a whole nation policy even yet. And so we need to get there. If we could have company business to business sharing of malicious source code, we don't quite have that yet. That would go a long way to stop these guys. If we could make sure that there are private sector incentives to get your cybersecurity right, I argue cyber insurance is a big part of that. It's going to get better and better and better over time. Right now, I got in trouble the last time I said this because I was in an insurance thing, but it's like a drunken monkey in the back room throwing a dart for what your premium is, right? Your premium is $20,000 a month, and we're running out of drunken monkeys, apparently. Oh, work with me, people. For God's sake, that's funny. I don't care where you are. And so what we're trying to do is, how do you actuarially determine what your risk is? So if I'm gonna give you a premium, I need to understand, well, what is my risk if I'm insuring you to do this? We're not very good at that today. Getting better, but we're not there. So that's the kind of thing you're going to see. You're going to see smaller companies. I encourage smaller companies to do this. Go through a managed service company, meaning don't try to create your own cybersecurity force inside your company if that's not what you do. Go find somebody that does that. And believe me, you'll sleep better at night. And if something goes wrong, you can call that guy and yell at them in the morning. I really think that's the way it's going. And if you see consolidation in the industry, it's going to this managed service concept.
Mike, we've got a very complex relationship with China. We love the potential of their markets. We know we have to be there. Businesses have to be there. They're going to succeed today, be profitable today, and yet we can't trust them. I mean, they steal our business circus, our secrets, and we have strong reasons to believe that they're have adopted the Soviet-style espionage tactics.
Yes, absolutely. Two interesting things on the espionage piece. So. The NKVD was the precursor to the KGB. Mm-hmm. So in the 1930s, they were very active in the United States. And they had recruited a member of Congress who they wanted to get onto the Anti-American Committee. So at that time, they were talking about fascism and communism being bad in the 1930s, leading up to World War II. And so what the Russians at that time wanted to do is they kept, through this particular policymaker, was trying to get the switched away from communism bad and to fascism terrible, right? Mm-hmm. And they had some success in doing it. That was pretty interesting because they were, it's really aggressive. They recruited a member of Congress to do this. He wasn't caught, by the way. He was caught after the fall of the Soviet Union. When we got archives, we realized the guy was on their payroll for years, right? Think of that. Just recently, a guy named Dickstein, Samuel Dickstein, you can look it up, from New York City. And by the way, he was just a bad guy that they recruited. He was just a bad person anyway. His code name from the Russians was Crook. Come on, that's funny too. Those Russians, they got a sense of humor.
That keeps it simple.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I tell you that story because fast forward to today, so the Chinese realize, you know what, some of these tactics in espionage work pretty well. So the Australians just caught a member of their parliament, a rising member of the party, who was basically selling secrets to Chinese intelligence and on their payroll, and at one point, and this was the tipping point, actually informed one of the Chinese agents operating in Australia that, hey, the government here has you under surveillance, you need to be really careful. Which, you know, that's not the brightest thing to do, yeah. Is be around the guy that's being surveilled and tell him you're being surveilled, right? Come on, couldn't have been the brightest spy. But which, if you think about it, they're actually adopting old-style Russian tactics. And now you add to that cybersecurity. Mm. It is amazing. So let me back up. If I wanted to recruit you, I used to be an FBI agent, if we wanted to go into an embassy and recruit somebody that works there to the United States to give us information, you would do something called a pattern of life. What is your pattern of life? I want to know everything I can about you so that when I approach you, you don't know if I'm friend or foe. You don't know if I'm with you or not with you. You don't know if I'm just the guy at the grocery store or I'm somebody else, right? That was part of this recruitment technique. Think about how much information is about every single one of you in this room today online. It cost me 20 minutes of computer time to know what it used to take me as an agent a year to develop. I know, and then if I can get on your social media pages, which is possible, I even know more. I know who your family, I know your contacts. Imagine that valuable information to recruit people, and the Chinese know it. And so they're doing these interesting things in espionage. And I'll try to make this short. They broke into OPM, Office of Professional Management, stole 22 million classified documents. And they're the SF-86s. I don't know if anyone in here got their letter. If you ever had a clearance, yep, some of the people got them. You got your letter that said, oh, by the way, the Chinese have your very sensitive secret information. Sorry, right? And you think, as an old FBI guy, you think, wow, if I were an intelligence guy, this is the best thing that ever happened to me. I know more about you, and now I use social media on top of it. I can craft an email that comes to you that is so believable, there is no way you're not going to click on the attachment. This is the social engineering trend that we're watching, especially the Chinese doing it. They also stole about 40 million healthcare records. Now imagine taking healthcare records and applying it to what I know on these SF-86s, and now I can even have a whole nother stream of emails I can shoot at you that sound so believable, who wouldn't click on it? And when they do that, they get around your firewall. That's how they're getting in, even to sophisticated cyber companies. Matter of fact, I had to redo my SF-86. I still do some classified work. I couldn't remember where I lived about 25 years ago, so I called the Chinese embassy. Ms. Bray? Best customer service I've ever had. They were on it like that. So this is kind of this trend that we see coming. And by the way, it's not slowing down. And that was one thing that didn't get talked about in the summit in North Korea. North Korea has invested a lot of money in their talent in cyber warriors because they know there's such a payoff at the end of the day.
So Donald Trump went to Singapore directly from the G7 meeting in Canada, which he left in shambles. And he made a pitch to bring Russia into the G7, make it to G8. Russia's not a top 10 economy. Why is he carrying Russia's water?
Look at the time. I have a flight to catch. I don't know. This is a great mystery to me. I think that Donald Trump believes he can be the guy that solves that problem. And he believes, like any deal he used to, if you go back to his time, I mean, he's a Queens real estate guy, right? And the best way is just to keep at you, right? Keep at you. I think that's where he's coming from. I'm not sure I buy the malicious part of it. I think some of it is a bit naive, especially how sophisticated the Russians are at manipulation and other things.
Is Putin blackmailing him?
I can't say that. As an FBI guy, I have seen nothing that would tell me that he's blackmailing him. I do think he has this odd admiration for Putin. And, you know, we're kind of turning our backs on our allies and kind of embracing our adversaries, which is guys like me went after Obama with viciousness on this. You know, we kept saying this is the wrong path. He's doing the same thing.
Are we seeing a realignment of our alliances, both in Asia and in Europe?
You know, listen, when he came out on China, I teared up with joy, right? Because they have been cheating in the trade space for a very long time. And if you're from Michigan, they've hurt us bad, right? Not only stealing our intellectual property, but basically making it damn near impossible to make auto parts and other things here and make any money at it. And so that part, I thought, this is great. We better at least tackle China when they are an export economy before they become a consumer economy like the United States. Once that happens, you're never going to change them. If they got there by stealing, they're going to continue to steal. So I thought this was a really bright moment where I thought that the Trump could actually get something done. But then 2 days later, he picks a fight with our European allies, and I'm not saying they've been perfect, including Canada, but yeah, I don't, you know, that two-front war thing doesn't ever seem to work, right? Mm. If you look at history. And you don't have to look that far back to understand why that's a problem. So we need our allies if you're going to negotiate a great deal in North Korea. We need our allies if you're going to negotiate a redeal on Iran. And, you know, was the value of picking that fight now, I look at it, my position would be no, I wouldn't have done that. I would have continued to put pressure on China because they deserve it. And we ought to make them good citizens in the international business or international trade and business. And they're not. So I thought that was good. I thought the European thing is probably going to cost him some opportunity to bring people to the table that we're going to need. We're going to need those people in North Korea. We're going to need those people in Iran.
Did Russia meddle in our election?
They certainly tried to. So this is the thing where I thought Democrats get this wrong and Republicans get it wrong as well. So we are so highly charged politically these days that if you say Russian interfered with our election, then they go, you're a horrible liberal Democrat and we should just choke you and put you on the street. And if you say, well, that never happened, there was no interference in our elections, you say, oh my God, you're one of those people and you should be thrown in the Detroit River or shot or both. Again, you have to work with me here. I think both of those positions are wrong, right? I look at it this way. We had two flawed candidates. One of those flawed candidates win. I don't think the Russians picked the candidate.
Did they try?
They tried to influence voters. But here's where, remember, they were doing it to both sides. Mm-hmm. What they originally wanted to do, this is where I thought we missed the boat on trying to really understand what the Russians are up to. They originally tried to damage Hillary Clinton. They wanted a wounded, battered American president. And by the way, their polls weren't any better than anyone else's polls. They thought she was going to win too. And so they thought, let's beat her up and make it nasty and we'll try to do these ads and influence and make her terrible, right? Yeah. Take a horrible person so when she became president. That probably switched somewhere in there where they said, well, let's just let's get more votes. And here's what they did that we should all be completely offended by and not walk away from this problem. They tried to get American on American. and they were successful. They tried to get Muslim American groups to go after white supremacist groups. They tried to get black activist groups against white supremacist groups. They would go out and say, show up at this place, we're going to have a rally for X. And then they count the counter group and say, show up at this place, we're going to have rally X. They wanted conflict. Now that gets my blood pressure up more than any other thing. Sure. They never changed a vote, there's no proof of that. But they were trying to influence the election, and the one thing they wanted to do was get us at each other's throats. And I would argue they have been very successful at doing it. And we haven't been able to unwind ourselves from, hey, the Russians were trying to do something bad. Mr. President, you're president. Hillary Clinton, I'm sorry you lost, but Americans just weren't ready for you, or whatever. Whatever the reasons is. But now let's focus on what they were doing, because they're trying to do it again in the 2018 election. They're doing it in France. Think of this. They went into, when the NATO-German rotation came up in Lithuania, and remember, we do these troop rotations there to show the Russians that we're unified, and you can't have the Baltics back, right? They don't want to go back. When the Germans showed up, think of the history of World War II, they showed up in Lithuania for their tour. There was a massive outrage, because social media exploded with the story that there was a 14-year-old girl, a Russian ethnic girl, who was raped by German soldiers who showed up on their NATO duty. Now, you think about the emotion, the angst, the history of that. This is a very powerful thing. Never happened. Never happened. And it took them about a month to try to get it back in the can. That's what the Russians are doing, and we shouldn't let them get away with it. We should not let them get away with it.
So how do we keep them out of our election, and are we even trying?
Well, we're behind the eight ball for sure. Mm-hmm. There's money the State Department has. I'm hoping that Secretary Pompeo releases some of that money to do state protection. So we know that the Russians tried to get into election systems in 23 states. They were not successful. That's the good news. So they never flipped a vote. They weren't able to do that. But they're not stopping. We know that they're continuing to try to figure that out. And they're continuing to try to find this way of influencing people on the internet. They have what we call Russian bot armies now. And I'm a part of a group that's trying to track this. It's called Hamilton 68. There's a great website if you want to know what the Russians are up to. Hamilton 68. You can see where they trend, what stories they try to elevate, what stories they try to suppress by these bot armies, meaning sometimes you might be reading something you think is your neighbor and it's a guy in Moscow, or worse yet, it's an artificial intelligence bot that they've algorithmed to be able to program to be in your inbox. And that, we're not sure exactly how we're gonna get our handle on it. This is a big problem and it's growing. And if you ask the next generation behind most of the folks in this room, they have more trust in the information on the internet than maybe I do. And that's worrisome, because there's no way to, it's very difficult to check it. That was really uplifting, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does Vladimir Putin want?
He wants to be back in power. So if he gave a speech, I think it was about 2006, and he said a couple of things. Here's my foreign policy. We're going to get Russia back on the national stage. Remember, they were kind of a third-rate, third-world country almost back then. We're going to do that. We're going to have Georgia, the country of Georgia, is not going to be in NATO. Remember, Georgia wanted to go to NATO. Ukraine is not going to be Western-leaning, meaning economically, or get into NATO. And we are going to be able to revamp our capabilities in nuclear submarines and their special forces. So if you fast forward, he gives that speech today in front of Parliament. Pretty hard to argue he didn't get everything he wants. The Russians now occupy 20% of Georgia. You've seen what they've done in the Ukraine. Their special forces are very, very good, and they've relaunched some very sophisticated nuclear subs. As a matter of fact, everything he does is messaging. I don't know if you remember, maybe it was 3 or 4 months ago now. Mm-hmm. He fired from a submarine their version of Tomahawk missiles into Syria. Right? Complete waste of military hardware and decision-making if your purpose was to just destroy those targets. If your purpose was to show the world that, by the way, we have submarines that can surface and fire missiles at you just like the United States can, very successful. So he's constantly messaging where he's at in the world. I think that's what he wants. He loves the fact that if you're going to solve Syria, you have to stop in Tehran, and you have to stop in Moscow to get it done. He loves that. That's exactly where they want to be.
So Mike, you started your career in the FBI, spent a number of years there. You were chairman of the Intelligence Committee, so you provided oversight for our intelligence gathering agencies. You look at the Mueller investigation and all of the various evidence that's surfacing, both in terms of the Russian meddling, as well as the controversy over the FBI and the Justice Department possibly putting their hand on the scale in favor of Trump. What's your take on what happened? Did the FBI, did the Justice Department try to defeat Donald Trump actively, and did they try to undermine his presidency once he was elected?
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue that they tried to advocate for one person winning or losing, with mm-hmm. with the exception of the Comey thing, which candidly I did not, the former FBI director, which I never understood. Mm-hmm. I think the only way we're going to know that is there's an Inspector General report coming out by Mr. Horowitz. That report, I think, will be the guiding light on what actually happened. I do think some senior level FBI agents made some horrific decisions. I hate to say it, pains me to say that mm-hmm. as a former FBI guy. I think they did. I disagreed when Comey came out and said we looked at it and the investigation's over. I thought FBI director should not be in that business, especially in a heated campaign. Never should even have been there. They should have done the normal course and sent it to DOJ and let the politicians deal with it. Then he came back out, and I vocally opposed that. And then he came out and said, nope, we think we found more emails, we're going to investigate. He got himself right back into the politics of it. I thought that was a terrible decision. And then came out again and said, nope, we didn't find anything here. I don't know why he went through that series of decisions. And I think when you tiptoe into politics in a very heated environment, you're going to lose your toe. And he lost his toe. And it was the wrong decision for the FBI. And, you know, they're doing incredible work around the country. And why this is damaging, if I may quickly. So I happened to be in a city giving a speech at a law school on cybersecurity, law and cybersecurity challenges. And I get a call from an old friend of mine who happens to be the boss of this particular office and says, hey, I hear you're in town. Would you mind coming over to the FBI? We could use a little bucking up. And I went, I've probably got a half an hour. When I'm done, I'll zip over, and then I had to go to the airport. He said, we'll pick you up. You know, and of course, when the FBI says they're going to pick you up, you get a little nervous. I'm like, do I need a lawyer, or am I okay? So we go over to the office, and in about 30 minutes, they had 200 FBI agents show up. And it wasn't because it was Mike Rogers. It was they were looking for any morsel of, hey, we feel under siege. And that day, they had an agent who was wounded going after an Asian organized crime gang in that particular town. And so that's the work they're seeing. That's the work they're doing every day. And they're thinking, scratching their head going, I don't know what's happening back there, but it doesn't reflect us. So I say that in the notion that we have to be careful. The FBI is a very important institution in the United States. They go after organized crime and kidnappers and pornography. Yeah, I think it does, unfortunately. I think they're going to have to earn the respect back of the American people, and that report, I hear, is pretty damaging, honestly. I haven't seen it, but people I know who are close to it said they're buckling up. It's not going to be a great day for them. It's due out any day now, I think.
Mike Rogers, thank you. We're going to turn things back to Tim.
A real big round of applause for Nolan. Tough questions. Thank you, Mike. And it's really hard to come up with questions when you have someone like Nolan asking all the questions at people.
He wasn't this nice when I was in Congress, I want you to know that.
Well, that's going to be part of the questions, too. You just touched, a lot of the questions are on Russia, and you touched on a hot topic with the FBI, and you shared a little bit of the morale. Someone asked, how do you fix it?
Who, me, personally? Have a drink and go back to bed? No, just kidding. Oh, I'm kidding. Don't do that. That would be bad. You mean how does the FBI face it, I guess?
Well, fix.
Oh,
the
fix
FBI.
It. I thought you said face it. I'm sorry. And I think Director Wray is doing the right thing. They got back to basics. You don't see him on TV a lot. You don't see him in the media a lot. He's refocusing on the mission of the FBI. And my advice to them was also talk a little bit more about the things you're doing right, because right now all we hear about is the things you're doing wrong. And they're doing a lot right around the country, a lot right. And so I'm hoping that they'll shift gears and do a little more of that. And I don't mean it's Director Wray up there in DC. I mean your local Detroit FBI office needs to be in the news saying, here's a great case we just solved to protect the citizens of Detroit and the great state of Michigan. We don't see enough of it. And I'm hoping that they'll start engaging more of that. Because I'll tell you, when I was an FBI guy, you didn't talk about nothing, no how, never, right? And that was just a sure way to get yourself fired or in jail. And they didn't do a great job of even marketing the things we were doing, right? Everybody wanted, even if you were an FBI press officer, you're like, I can't really talk to the press. I mean, that was the easiest job in the FBI. You know what? Are you ready? No comment. You do that all time, all day long, that's what you do. And so I think they've got to re-engage in that old notion about what the Bureau does, what, how they're part of communities, and then they need to heal the leadership. You know, there needs to be some accountability if they overstep their bounds in the leadership office. And I unfortunately think that's coming.
So when you served, another question here, the oversight committees by the congressional offices, have we lost touch?
Yeah, well, my biggest fear is that it becomes so partisan. You know, the same three facts can be looked at by one party or the other party, and then they decide to beat on each other over the interpretation of those three facts. That is just not healthy. I mean, I'm a big believer in the separate and independent institution of the United States Congress. It's a big deal. And when people are doing their work because they think it's a partisan advantage, I don't think that's any better than the FBI having some political motive in anything they do. Even if you're a partisan on a committee, having a subpoena power is a big deal. I mean, that is the most evasive thing I can do to you and your freedom, right, is subpoena something, your information or you, make you testify. And when people start muddying up what is partisan and what is fact, I'm very worried about the future of that. And I, you know, candidly, the committee I used to chair just breaks my heart to watch it. I think it's a mess. I don't think they'll accomplish anything. And then even if they both do reports, is anyone going to believe either report? You're probably like, well, that sounds like a Democrat report or a Republican report. Do I believe that? I worry that I don't. We need to get back to this notion that even though you're a party member of X, Congress is a separate and equal branch of government under the Constitution. And with that comes a serious responsibility. Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Mom.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we're going to hear more about that, and Nolan, you'll be doing a great job prompting those discussions. Pivoting, since we're in the automotive world, the autonomous vehicle and their future, and cybersecurity and the threats. Have you or your insights touched on any of that yet?
Have. I mean, I think it's incredibly transformational. I do worry that we are hindered in America by convenience. So how many in here read the last privacy agreement of some application, or even if you're trying to get on the internet on an airplane? Yeah, one. Yeah, that's been, and you're probably only got three quarters of the way through it because the flight was so short, right? This is a problem. We decide that we want it efficient. I want it right now. I want to talk to somebody now. I want what that app has to offer now. We don't think about security, and neither do the developers when they're trying to develop that app and get it to you. Now, right now, I know there's some folks working on security in autonomous vehicles. I just think we're a long way away from this. The vulnerabilities of that vehicle, because it has so many IP addresses, so much information being exchanged every day, and if they're going to work, think of that information has to be real-time fast. That means every time that's happening, that is a vulnerability for somebody to latch onto. And when you think of the ability now with automation, and if we ever get to quantum computing, you know, whoever comes in second is not going to like that race. We have some huge security challenges. And I don't care if people say, I can secure this car at this point. Well, if you're traveling through and you're touching other nodes, guess what? Probably can't. So I think we're a long way from the security portion of it. The good news is I don't think we've got autonomous vehicles clearly. They haven't got the bugs worked out, right? It's taken some lives, crashed vehicles. There's going to be some time to get this piece right. But we better start building in security before we get to the convenience part. Otherwise, we're going to lose this race.
So obviously, the crowd is full of technology. Going from the automotive and the manufacturing, and you touched on the banks, what about the utilities? There seems to have been some thought and a few questions regarding the utilities.
Yeah, so the utilities have this huge challenge, heavily regulated. And the problem is the cybersecurity challenge is pretty great. So even if you have a good perimeter security, and that's candidly in cybersecurity, that's the old romantic notion about security. So if you hear somebody go ranting on about perimeter security, they're probably about 5 or 6 years out of date. because I work now to get around your perimeter security. That's what I spend my time doing. Very rarely do we find folks who are sophisticated trying to get through your security. Those are the criminals. By the way, they have success too. But most of the big complicated folks who want to turn out our lights are using a whole host of others. And so, candidly, we're going through these challenges of how we stop that. And quick example, the Russians, they got honked off. They went into a steel manufacturing plant in Germany and shut down all the safety protocols on a smelting operation. And so there was no heat control. And for those of you who understand that, that means at some point something's going to blow up, and it did. And they couldn't shut it down. So they went through the security, through the SCADA system security, all the way down to that smelting control system, and were able to manipulate it. That's the same kind of thing you get in an electric grid. And by the way, we're at a we're at an advantage and a disadvantage because of the way we control electricity in the grid, but it also puts us at a disadvantage on security because if they shut it down, we're not going to get it back. It's not going to come back today or tomorrow or next week. Can you imagine the East Coast? Or let's just revamp that. Imagine just New York City loses power for 30 days. There's going to be chaos. What do you do with food, cash? How do I get out? How do I get gasoline? This is why people worry about this. And that's why we were worried when we saw the Russians, again, about 6 months ago. This is a public report came out and said, Russians were working pretty hard to get into our electric grid. And it wasn't because they wanted to figure out how we did it. I think it was try to figure out. They may have not done it, but they wanted the capability to turn off our lights.
Thank you.
Serious. Yep.
A security question, not necessarily cyber, but it may have a reach into it. Someone asks, what about school safety?
We just had this chat at the table. I think the very first line of defense is getting students into the understanding that they're responsible for their fellow students. Meaning, we saw in every one of those shooting cases, if you look back and do the forensics on it, somebody knew something bad was about to happen. Maybe they didn't know they were going to show up at the school and shoot people. And as one of the students, I think, aptly said, it was a bullying problem of which they see in their schools as well. We have to get after, at the very basic level, we're going to argue about the politics of the legislation for months, maybe even years. But the things that we can impact are how we get our students engaged in this, including anti-bullying. And if you see something like that, you got to have an outlet for it. You have to be able to go to someone in relatively safety to yourself and say, I'm not sure, but this doesn't look right to me. You know, he's got a pickup truck full of ammunition and rifles, and on his social media, he's saying he wants to kill a lot of people. You know, we need those students to be able to, they see it, they have seen it. Now we need them engaged and to help us understand. Guess what? It's not just you. It's your fellow classmates, too. You're responsible as much as I am.
Okay, I get the two questions. Looking out 20 years from now, and I know you'll be as young and vivacious as you are right now, what do you see?
How many?
20 years.
I'm on the beach with my wife somewhere with a Mai Tai and two umbrellas. That's how good it is. You know, I don't know. Who knows? You know, I've never say never if you're asking, would I ever get back into politics? I think I would. I don't think people should be there forever. A lot of people, when I walked out, I was at the top of my game, and, you know, I was the chairman of a powerful committee, and we were getting things done. We had a budget every year. We did all the things you're supposed to do. And people say, oh, my God, there must be something wrong. You must have done something horribly wrong. No, I just accomplished what I accomplished and was ready to hand the baton to somebody else. And I wish we'd get more into that in our national discussion on politics. I'm not a term limit guy, by the way. I just think that you'll know when you know. I tell my other members who are thinking about getting out or staying in, I said, you'll know. You'll get up one day and go, it's time. Time for me to go. And so I've never said I wouldn't come back. In what capacity, who knows. But I think government service is an important thing. And we should never just walk away and give up on it. As bad and as ugly as it looks, we shouldn't walk away and give up on it. Because I have traveled all over the world, and there is, for all our bumps and bruises, I don't find a better system in the world than the one we have in the United States.
Well, thank you very much. Everybody give Mike Rogers and Nolan Finley a big round of applause.
Thank you, sir.
And now we're going to have a little bit of fun. Mike's been warned, but this is something Steve and the staff have come up with. It's called Lightning Round. So real quick answers to these quick questions, okay? Something on your bucket list, Mike?
The Amalfi Coast in Italy.
Ah.
Person you would like to have lunch with?
Thomas Jefferson.
One of your favorite songs.
I hear
songs.
He's busy, that's the only thing.
One of your favorite songs?
It's a Wonderful World. It was my wedding song.
Aw.
Thank you.
Favorite team growing up?
Detroit Tigers.
Your best sport?
My best sport?
Yep.
Bench. Football.
And that's another topic on the NFL. Last book you read?
Last book I read, Quantum Spy by David Ignatius.
One of your favorite movies?
The Godfather.
Oh, I thought he was going to say Jason Bourne.
No, it's the FBI guy in me. Can't help it.
Your favorite vacation spot?
Favorite vacation spot is a little place on Beaver Island of Michigan where my phone does not work. It's a little cabin. My wife failed. Yeah.
Bravo. Bravo. This is a favorite for all of us. Describe Detroit in one word.
Rebound. Coming back.
Amen. And take a little time on this one. And again, I'm so sorry that you all couldn't be a part of the students' reception and things that you were saying to the students. But if you had to talk to yourself, your 25-year-old self, what would you say?
Was I drinking when I was talking to my... Funny question. I would just say, continue to stretch. Don't fall into that rut. Just continue to push yourself. Whatever you're doing, whatever it is, be great at it. And if you're great at it, try to be extra great at it. And if you want to do something else, push yourself there. The one thing I've noticed, a lot of people give up on themselves at some point in their careers. And it's sad to watch because there are a lot of talented people kind of humming along. I think people need to just challenge themselves. I'm an executive producer on a TV series. I couldn't spell executive producer last year. Always learning, learn something new, and be the first guy in and the last guy out every day. That's the advice I give my kids. You do that, and you'll be just fine at whatever you're doing.
Another round of applause for Mike.
Thanks, everyone.
Nolan. And don't take so long to come back. Well done.
Thanks. Mike Rogers, thank you for your leadership and your thought leadership and for being with us today. One more time, Mike Rogers.
Thanks, everybody.
Nolan Finley, great job. We love listening to you, reading to you. Thanks for being with us. Tim Cott, if you liked the program today, you thank Tim Cott on the way out because he was responsible for convincing Congressman Rogers to be with us. So thank you. And as your gift, I was going to give you some chocolate cake to carry out, but I figure you can lick your sleeve on the way out. So thank you again to Tim Cott. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us. This meeting is now adjourned. On time, every time. See you next time.